This is Your Life, episode number 8.
This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about how to benefit from setbacks and failures. And this is something I've learned the hard way by failing my way through the process. And I want to just share some of the failures I've experienced over the years and what I've learned from them. First, let me just begin with a few announcements. I'm going to be doing the Backstage Leadership Program at the Chick-fil-A LeaderCast on May the 4th in Atlanta. And I hope you'll join us for this conference. It's awesome. I'm going to have the privilege of interviewing the speakers as they come off the stage, as I've done every year for the last 3 years. This is going to include this year, get this, Tim Tebow, Marcus Buckingham, John Maxwell, Soledad O'Brien, Patrick Lencioni, Andy Stanley, Coach Urban Meyer, and many others. Now, this event is going to be in Atlanta live, about 6,000 people there at the primary location in Atlanta. But that's not the only way to experience the Chick-fil-A LeaderCast, because it's a simulcast. Last week, I said that it's going to be broadcast or simulcast to about 100 different locations around the world. Jason Teagle, who's the general manager for the conference, corrected me in an email this week, and he said, no, Mike, it's like 750 to 800 different locations around the world, but about 150,000 people watching. So even if you can't attend the conference in Atlanta, which I recommend because the live experience is second to none, it's still an extraordinary experience as a simulcast. So go to the Chick-fil-A LeaderCast website, and there's a link in the show notes, and just see if there's going to be a session near you. If it's going to be simulcast in a church or a business that's in your location, I'll bet it is, and it's worth attending. Second announcement is the Blog World and the New Media Expo in New York City on June the 5th through the 7th. I'm going to be speaking there. I'll be leading one of the super sessions on Thursday morning, June the 7th at 9 a.m. To be honest, not quite sure what I'm going to speak about yet. Probably something having to do with my new book, Platform, and especially what I'm learning about podcasting, because I'm having to take everything that I learned from the blogging world in building my platform and start kind of as a newbie as a podcaster. And I'm, you know, taking 3 steps forward and stumbling back 2 steps, and I'm having to do this all for myself again. So I just think I'll share that in real time and how I'm following my own principles, how I'm taking my own medicine and learning to build a different kind of platform or build a new media channel through podcasting. There is a registration link in the show notes for Blog World. And if you register before May the 15th, you get a $100 discount on the 3-day bloggers and podcaster pass. So if you've ever thought about coming, this would be a great year to do it. I am so pumped up about attending myself. This has been like on my bucket list for years. But the thing I'm most looking forward to, not only hearing the other speakers, but most importantly, networking with other bloggers and podcasters who share my passion about new media. So I'm looking forward to learning a lot and hopefully being able to pass on some information that's useful to everybody else as well. So let's dive into the content. As I said, I want to talk today about setbacks and failures and specifically why I think it's important that we learn how to process these. Because if you're out to create something significant, if you're going to be taking on big projects, let me tell you, you're going to encounter failure. It's inevitable. But if you don't have a way to process it, you're going to get stuck. And you're probably going to just, you know, fall back into some patterns that are not going to be that constructive and are not going to further what you're trying to create in terms of your objectives and your goals and so forth. So let me just start with maybe the most colossal failure I've ever experienced in my life. And not only was this a ginormous failure, but it was also one of the best learning opportunities I ever experienced. Now, honestly, I wouldn't want to go back and repeat this, but I also wouldn't trade the experience for anything, because there's some things that you only learn by failing, and this is one of them. So it was back in 1991. I had started a publishing company with Robert Wagemuth, who to this day is still one of my best friends, but we started a publishing company in 1986, with the dream of becoming kind of a major player in the publishing industry and making a major contribution. And we were passionate about books and passionate about getting the kinds of books that we wanted to publish out to the world. The only problem was by about 1991, we realized that we were going to have to step it up in terms of our distribution, that the distribution we had, which was basically our own in-house sales force, just wasn't going to get us to the next level. So we entered into this agreement with another publishing company that became our distributor. And I'm not going to mention who it is for the sake of protecting the guilty. But suffice it to say, they promised us that they would exponentially increase our distribution. And you know, honestly, I think they had the best intentions. I think that's what they wanted. It just didn't work out. Our sales were running about $400,000 a month before we entered into this distribution agreement. So we were on track to do about $5 million in that year, 1991. The problem was the first year into this distribution, or the first month into this distribution arrangement, we went from $400,000 a month to $40,000, 10% of what we'd been generating on our own without this big, you know, fancy distribution system. Just our guys, just our own guys who were making the sales call and doing it in what we thought was kind of a homespun backward way. And so the sophisticated guys that were supposed to be pros at this decreased our sales dramatically. Well, it was catastrophic to us, as you can imagine. I mean, when you go from cash flow of $400,000, and by the way, we were spending it all because we were on a pretty significant growth curve, and publishing is a very capital intensive business. You've got to invest in inventory. You have to ship all these books to the retailers, and they don't pay you really until the books are sold through. And so it's very expensive. And so all of our cash was tied up in inventory and accounts receivable. So we went from $400,000 to $40,000. And I mean, we hit the red panic button. So we called the distributor. We had this big powwow with them. And they said, look, guys, don't sweat it. It's going to be okay. We're going to get this figured out. This is just kind of their ramp up. We didn't really expect this, but it's going to be okay. Looking back on it, it's probably, you know, probably something we should have anticipated, but we didn't, but it'll be okay. So we said, well, man, guys, we hope so, because we cannot continue on this sales trajectory and survive. This is going to kill us. So they said, no problem. Next month, exactly the same result. I don't think in the next 7 months that their distribution ever got above $60,000 a month. And again, we were doing $400,000 a month before we entered into this relationship. Well, we couldn't survive. So we went to them and we said, you guys have got to do something. You got to help us here. You promised us, we're in this distribution agreement. You're not going to let us out of it. So you've got to help us. So they said, okay, how about this? How about if we advance you against the sales that we're going to inevitably generate? They were still positive that they would generate these sales once they got up to speed. And so we said, okay. So they gave us essentially what amounted to a loan, but secured by the assets that we had in the business, our intellectual property, our inventory, et cetera. What we didn't know was that meanwhile in the background, their parent company, in fact, they didn't even know it, their parent company was negotiating to sell this distribution company. And in fact, they did. They entered into a definitive agreement to sell the distribution agreement. And in the process of cleaning up their own balance sheet, they called us and said, guys, we hate to tell you this, but we've got to call that loan. And you have 30 days to pay back to us $1.1 million. I mean, you know, we hyperventilated and we didn't know what to do. We went to our board. We explained the situation. Our board was very thoughtful about it. But the truth was, nobody had that kind of money, and they weren't willing, if they did, to put it into the business. And so, in essence, we went bankrupt. I mean, we didn't even have enough assets because they were all pledged to this distributor. We didn't have enough assets to really go bankrupt. But in effect, that's what happened. I mean, we had to shut down the business. We had to let our 14 employees go. And I remember specifically, after the moving truck came and took all of our furniture, took every piece of equipment that we had in the office, after we'd let our people go, I remember sitting in Robert's office, an empty office, with only one piece of equipment in it, which was a landline telephone that was connected to the wall. I don't know if you remember those. It was before the days of cell phones, just right before the days of cell phones. And we were just sitting there on the floor, and frankly, we were crying. I mean, we were just so discouraged, wondering what had gone wrong. So this was one of those times when I just thought, I'm throwing in the towel. I'm quitting. This is too painful. It's too hard. But, you know, long story short, was we kind of started working and piecing together another business. And Robert spent most of his time shutting down the old publishing business. And we continue to answer the phone, answer questions from our vendors, answer questions from our authors, and tried to walk through that experience with integrity, but it was very difficult. Meanwhile, while Robert shut down that business, I went off and got a literary agency that we also co-owned until 1998. And that ended up being very successful. Robert is still running that company, and he's one of the literary agents out there that I highly recommend to people. But I left in 1998 to come back to Thomas Nelson to get back into the corporate side of publishing. But that wasn't my last failure. I mean, I wished it was. I wish you only had like one of those that you go through and then you don't have to go through it again. But no, you know, I find that I continue to fail my way forward, as John Maxwell says in his book, Failing Forward. But then in 1996, now by this time, we've got a literary agency and we were doing pretty well. But out of the clear blue, at least it felt that way, my biggest client fired me in 1996, but he did it by fax. Another technology that has pretty much gone away, but in the day, that was like the most immediate way to communicate to somebody. So he didn't pick up the phone and call me. He didn't fly to Nashville and sit down and visit with me. He didn't ask me to come to where he was located to sit down and visit with him. Instead, he sends this very impersonal fax and fires me. I'm going to tell you, it killed me. I thought, here we go again. I just want to quit. I'm tired of working in this business. I don't know who to trust. I mean, I went through a very dark period that lasted several weeks, and I just had to take some time off and just clear my head and kind of recover from that kick in the gut and decide what I want to do with the rest of my life. So, you know, inevitably I got back in the game and worked through it, but it was very tough. Another failure, and this is the last one I'll tell you. But in 1998, I had huge success with my first book, which ended up on the New York Times list. And so I suddenly found myself in a position where I was making more money than I'd ever made in my life. And so I invested in this tax shelter. I thought I was very smart at the time. I thought I was getting good advice. And it seemed to make a lot of sense. It logically seemed like it was unassailable, like it was an airtight case and this was good for me and it was all legal and all that, except it wasn't. And so about 2002, I get a letter from the IRS and they said, you know, we understand that you participated in this tax shelter and this company that was selling these tax shelters is under a IRS investigation. And guess what? Now you and I don't know, they'd sold this to like 3,000 different people, 3,000 of your closest friends are also under an investigation. And that took like 3 years to resolve. I was in a formal audit process for about 3 years and it was a nightmare. I finally settled with the IRS. I ended up paying tens of thousands of dollars to the IRS in taxes that I owed and in penalties. And it was one of those experiences where every time I would get a letter from the IRS, my heart would sink. And I would just, the blood would drain from my face and my palms would get sweaty. And I just thought, oh my God, what now? And the worst part about it was that the IRS didn't seem to really even know what it was doing because I kept getting these different letters from different branches. And, you know, it was all over the map. You know, one letter would say I owed $40,000 and another letter would say, no, we're giving you an $18,000 tax refund. And they even sent the check in that case. And then another one where they said I owed over $100,000. And I mean, it was, you know, just a roller coaster of emotion going through this. So, you know, I learned a lot of lessons in that. I mean, not the least of which is you need a second opinion when it comes to taxes and you need to be careful and be conservative. But it was one of those lessons where I would never in a million years want to repeat that. But I learned so much in the process that I use today about due diligence and about scrutinizing things that seem too good to be true and really looking them over and doing my homework. But again, those were big failures that were painful and I learned a lot from them and it would be really easy. And I've seen a lot of people do this when they go through those experiences is they tend to get cynical. They tend to get bitter even. And I didn't want that to happen to my heart. And so I'm going to talk a little bit in a minute here about what I did to kind of process that. And even that process is something I'm still learning. But in addition to the big failures, and I don't know where you're at. I don't know if you've gone through those kind of big failures. I've had friends that have gone through divorces and friends who've lost children and friends who've seen businesses fail. And I've got one friend who's been unemployed for months now, and it's the second time he's been unemployed during the recession. And really, through no fault of his own, I mean, it's just something that, from at least the outward appearances, is something that happened to him. And it's really hard in those situations not to lose heart. Sometimes, though, the failures are just what I would call setbacks. And this is something really less than a failure. I mean, it's not catastrophic like what I described. It's not all-consuming like the experiences that I just shared with you. But sometimes it's just setbacks. Like last week, for example, I was at a speaking engagement, and I thought I'd done a reasonable job preparing for it. But when I stood up on stage to speak, it's like there was no energy in the audience. And I just felt like I couldn't get anything going. And if you're a speaker, you'll know what I'm talking about. You feed off the audience's energy. And I wish that weren't true. But sometimes an audience can make you or break you. And these people weren't bad people. I take full responsibility for the fact that they weren't energized by my content. But it was tough to be there and to walk off the stage and feel like, man, I just didn't connect. I don't feel like I engaged with the audience like I should have. And then a friend of mine texted me on Saturday because he was at a speaking engagement where he was a speaker. And he said, oh my gosh, he said, everything went wrong. The microphone system didn't work. I brought the wrong adapter to connect my slides. And gosh, do you ever go through the same experience? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I just had a similar experience this week. And he ended up writing a terrific blog post about this. His name is Jeff Goins, and he wrote a great blog post about staying in the game and the fact that you're failing means that you're in the game. And that's kind of what separates the professionals from the amateurs, is the professionals pick themselves up and keep moving forward, put another foot in front of the last one and keep making forward progress. Well, so that was speaking. Another recent one is just this whole podcasting experience. You know, I thought it was going pretty well. It's been a challenge, to be honest with you, to get the show prep done. I've been spending like maybe 6 hours an episode. And I, you know, this is just a true confession, but I tend to be a chronic over-preparer. I don't care if I'm speaking. If I was preparing in the old days when I was the CEO of Thomas Nelson for Investor Call when we were a public company, man, I just wanted to leave no stone unturned. Every T crossed, every I dotted. I wanted to be thoroughly prepared, just kind of like the old Boy Scout motto, be prepared. I didn't want to be embarrassed by not knowing the answer or not knowing where I was going next. So I've been really thorough in preparing for the podcast. The only problem is it's not sustainable. I really can't spend 6 to 8 hours a week preparing for the podcast. So I had invited Cliff Ravenscraft, who, if you're not listening to his podcast, you should. It's called Podcast Answer Man. He actually has several of them, but that's the one with which I'm most familiar, and he's been an enormous help to me. And so he contacted me a while ago, and he said, Mike, he said, you're having some audio problems. There's an echo in your audio, and there's some breathing noises, and I think I can fix it. But I'm going to be in Nashville for PodCamp Nashville. And how about if I just swing by and I'll look at your setup and I'll, you know, see what I can do to make it better. And I said, man, that's a terrific idea. And Cliff has been very helpful in the past to me. And I thought that would be super. So he came in, we spent some time chit-chatting, great guy, wonderful opportunity to just get acquainted and learn a little bit more about his story and what makes him tick and what drives him. And so then we fixed the echo, at least to a large part. You may hear some of it now, but we think we fixed most of it. As it turns out, I mean, it's really like stupid. I had a cable plugged into the wrong jack. So it was bypassing my, and this is more information than you want to know, but bypassing my gate limiter. So it wasn't cutting out the breathing noise. So that's why you were hearing me breathe so heavily, which I didn't notice till he pointed it out. And then that's like all I could hear. But then Cliff said to me, he said, Mike, I want to talk to you about the medium of podcasting, because he said, I feel like your podcast, and he'd listened to several episodes. He said, I feel like your podcast is coming across as a lecture and it needs to be a conversation. This is a medium designed for the conversation. And he was very gracious in how he said it. And he said, you know, I love a lot of stuff about your podcast. It's great content. But he said, I think you've got to master the medium. And so he said, let me just ask you a question. He said, are you standing up when you're doing your podcast, when you're recording your podcast? And I said, well, absolutely. I mean, there's my stand-up desk and I'm standing up. And he said, okay, that's part of the problem. He said, this is a little simple thing, but when you stand up, I think you're going into speaker mode. In other words, you're communicating like you were giving a speech or giving a lecture. And it feels like that. It just kind of feels wooden, a little bit too structured, a little bit too prepared, a little overthought. And so he said, I think if you sit down, that would help too. And he said, how much time are you spending preparing? So I told him, you know, 6 to 8 hours in the preparation. And he was like, dude, that is way too much time. You cannot do a podcast and make it a podcast that really connects with people if you're spending that much time preparing. I mean, yeah, the content may look great on paper, but it's not going to be that engaging for the listener because it needs to feel like a conversation. And then he also suggested, he said, you know, he said, I think the best way to really learn this medium and for you to take advantage of your own strengths is to do a question answer format where you let your listeners call in and they leave you a recorded message. And by the way, he does this on Podcast Answer Man, and lots of podcasters do this, but then you respond to the question, not with a lot of preparation, but just kind of almost shooting from the hip. Because Cliff said to me, he said, because you have more knowledge than you think, more experience than you think. You're preparing for you to take you to the next level. But we're talking about taking your listeners who are not at your level to the next level. And you need to really base that on your experience and your knowledge and not just go in there and, you know, do a lot of preparation and have it all structured and perfect, because it's not going to be perfect. You're going to connect a lot more with people if you're authentic, if you're transparent, and if it's unscripted. Well, I thought that was great. Now I'm going to tell you, whenever I get criticism, even from somebody who's gracious like Cliff and right, like I'm convinced that Cliff is, it's still hard. I mean, I may have a smile on my face about it, and I may be nodding and graciously receiving it, but it's still hard. It's still hard for me to get criticism because I don't know, I'm a people pleaser by nature, and I want to please people, and I want to know that what I'm doing is extraordinary. I have very high standards for myself, and to think that I was missing it was tough. So I went through, you know, 24 hours where, you know, I really processed that. And I want to tell you how I processed it, because this is something that I've used whenever I fail at something, and something I've shared with other people when they go through a failure. But it basically is about how to turn failure to your advantage by taking 6 steps. And, you know, I'm sorry, I think in steps. That's just the way my mind works. And hopefully you like that too. It's something you can write down and follow, and it's in the show notes as well. But step number one is to acknowledge the failure. Once you acknowledge your failure, I don't care if it's something as big as a bankruptcy or a failed marriage, or it's just something like your blog is not where you'd like it to be, or a blog post didn't work, or you tweeted out something that got a lot of criticism. Once you acknowledge failure, you take away its power. Because part of the reason that we live in fear of failure is we're afraid of being embarrassed. We're afraid of being thought of as inadequate. But once we admit the failure, the worst is over. And that's what I did in this situation with the podcast. I had to say, okay, this is not what I thought it was, because now I've got a guy who is the podcast answer man. I mean, he's all things podcast, who's consulted with lots and lots of people, who runs a terrific podcast mastermind group where people help one another, and Cliff also helps them. And for him to say, this is where it needs to go, I could own that. Yes. Okay. It's not perfect. It still needs a lot of work. Let's stop pretending and let's try something else. So that's what I'm going to do. Step number two is to take full responsibility. Now, this is really hard because it's really easy for us to want to blame someone else. It was really easy in the situation where my business failed, frankly, to want to blame the distributor. It was their fault. Or in the situation with the IRS, I could have made the IRS the bad guys, or for sure the guys that sold me the tax shelter. you know, it's their problem. But the truth is, I was the one, at least me and my partner, we were the ones who entered into the agreement with the distributor. You know, we could have done better homework. We could have done our due diligence. Same thing with the tax situation. Did I get a second opinion? No. The IRS was not the bad guy in this situation. I was the bad guy for not doing my homework. And even in the speaking engagement last week where I didn't feel like I really connected with people, you know, I can't just blame that on the audience. I don't want to blame it on the audience because either as a speaker, I have the ability to move people and to energize them, or I don't. I mean, the audience comes and that's really what they're paying me for, is to stimulate them, to motivate them, to energize them. So I think to take full responsibility for it is really critical. Third step, mourn the failure. I am not about just happy talking your way, you know, into a better mindset. I think there are a lot of experiences that we go through that we have to process emotionally, and grieving is a necessary part of processing failure and getting over the past. And I think that when we don't do that, those things rear their ugly head later and do a lot of damage in our relationships. So to mourn the failure and you know, cry if you have to, pout if you have to, you know, you don't want to stay there, but mourning the failure is a necessary part of turning failure to your advantage. So that's step three. Step four, learn from the experience. Learn from the experience. Now, my mind naturally tends to go this way. Once I kind of go through the grieving process, I start asking myself the question, okay, I failed at this. What does it make possible? Especially in my growth as a leader and as an individual, what can take place in terms of my character? How can I grow from this? How can I become a better person, a better business person, a better leader? So learn from the experience. I remember reading when I was a philosophy major, Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, he was a 19th century German philosopher who once said, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. And that's really true. It's true. It's something I've repeated to my daughters over and over again when they've had a bad experience. I try to wait now till they've mourned the experience and not try to be too quick about this, but to realize that this really is designed for their benefit. And, you know, in my own worldview, I'm not telling you you have to believe this, but in my own worldview, I really do believe that God has a plan and that God orchestrates a lot of these experiences for our good, because he wants to grow us and he wants us to express outwardly what he's building inwardly. And so, you know, I do think it's for our good. One of my mentors, one of my coaches is a lady named Eileen Meething, who works for Gap International. And you can find out more about her at gapinternational.com. But she would ask the question in processing failure. She'd say, ask yourself what is missing rather than what is wrong. That's a great question, because when you ask the question, what was wrong or what did I do wrong, it immediately makes you want to blame yourself or blame other people. And it doesn't generally lead to forward motion. But when you ask yourself, okay, what was missing? Then that's a little bit more of an objective question that kind of takes the sting out of it. And it's not that you don't own it, but it allows you to be a little more objective and to learn from the experience. So what is missing rather than what is wrong? Step number five, change your behavior. You know, once I get to this process, I start asking myself the question, okay, what can I do differently? I mean, from that business example, my business failure, I learned that I've got to do my homework, that I can't put all my eggs in one basket. I mean, there were so many lessons that I distilled from that experience of catastrophic failure. My tax situation, I need a second opinion. If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Now, we've heard that all of our lives, but to actually process that and internalize it is huge. It was huge for me. Even in the speaking situation last year, to change my behavior, to say, okay, look, what I did last week didn't work. I'm not going to blame it on the audience. I'm going to own this responsibility. What can I do differently next time so that I could get a different outcome? So step five is to change your behavior. Another philosopher, George Santayana, said, those who cannot learn from history are destined to repeat it. And we all know those people who keep doing the same things again and again, expecting a different result. And somebody said, I can't remember who it was, that that's the definition of insanity. And it is. Step number six, and this is huge, enter wholeheartedly into the next project. Enter wholeheartedly into the next project. I remember when I was a little boy, my dad bought me this little pony. And I may have told the story on the podcast. I can't remember. I did blog about it recently. But I got in this horse for the first time, and I was on a freshly plowed field. And this will become important in a reason in a moment when I tell you the reason. But my dad put me on the horse. He slapped the horse on the fanny, and the horse began trotting off. Well, I promptly fell off the horse. And fortunately, as I said, it was a freshly plowed field. So I wasn't hurt. I just landed in the soft dirt, and I was crying. My dad came up and comforted me, let me mourn it. And he said, okay, son, it's time to get back on the horse. That's critically important. That's an important lesson for all of us. You don't want to give power to the failure by refusing to take on new challenges. And that so often happens to us. I can tell you in my own business, when that client fired me, I wanted to quit. But instead, I was able, through the encouragement of my partner and my family, to get back on the horse and get re-engaged with clients and keep moving forward. And everything that I've failed at, I've fortunately picked myself up, dusted myself off, and keep moving forward. But there's a temptation to quit. If by the way, you feel that temptation to quit, if you want to throw in the towel, throw up your hands, walk off the field, congratulations, you're normal. I think that's most people's experience when they go through a failure. And it's kind of a necessary part of it. But hopefully you'll press on and get to the point where you can say, okay, I've learned so much through this experience that I'm going to do much better the next time out. So I'm going to turn failure to my advantage by entering wholeheartedly into the next project. And so many times when I've done that, the success I've experienced has been commensurate with the failure that I went through. And sometimes I even think that you're not going to get to success without that kind of failure. And I will say this, because I've worked with a lot of best-selling authors and people that suddenly became famous, that people who don't go through that failure and then they experience sudden success are often unbearable individuals to be around, because they just think, you know, everything they touch turns to gold, that they've got this magic dust that's been sprinkled on them, and they just don't have a lot of patience. They don't have a lot of empathy for other people. And like I said, they're insufferable. They're not the kind of people whose character is exemplary or people that I want to be around. So enter wholeheartedly into the next project. So again, I don't know what you're going through, but I just want to ask you this question, and you can respond in the discussion area on this post, the show notes that accompany this podcast. But where are you stuck? Where are you stuck in turning failure to your advantage? What stage are you in? What step are you? And I would just say, if there's any other steps you need to embrace, do it. But realize this is a process, and you're going to get through this. Look, I don't have any listener questions for this week, because I'm changing the format of the podcast for next week, and I'm soliciting questions even now. I'm going to talk in the next podcast about work-life balance. I Twittered out a question about work-life balance, and I've already had several responses, and I'm going to take those questions in the next podcast. But all that to say, I don't have any listener questions for this week, but this is going to be the driving force for this podcast going forward. Is it going to work? I don't know. You know, we're going to try it. I'm trying to be experimental and fail rapidly until I can find the right format that I'm comfortable with. That doesn't take, you know, 6 to 8 hours to prepare. And most importantly, I want to add value to you. So if you think that this podcast format is better than the last podcast format, or the one that I'm proposing by taking questions is better, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. But I think Cliff's onto something, and I'm taking his advice seriously. In the meantime, you can go to michaelhyatt.com/voicemail and leave me a message with your question about work-life balance. Even if you just have a comment. I had one person who phoned in a terrific comment about work-life balance, and I'll share that next week. But if you've got a comment, that would be great too. But this is going to be a show driven by your questions and my responses. And if I don't know the answer to the question, I'm going to tell you that too. So that's about it for this episode of This Is Your Life. And I do want your feedback. You can email me at feedback@michaelhyatt.com. You can also call me at 615-656-5001. 5001. And full disclosure, I will not be picking up the phone and taking your call personally, but that's a voicemail line. It's one other way to connect with me in addition to the michaelhyatt.com/voicemail, which allows you to talk into the computer and leave a voicemail. So any of those three methods are great. One of the things I would also ask you to do is to rate me on iTunes. I've never asked you to do this. I've got about 64 ratings at last count. There's a link in the show notes, but that would be very helpful to me as I get the word out, because frankly, that drives the show up on the listing on iTunes and helps people discover this podcast who may not be familiar with it. You can also find more resources on my blog at michaelhyatt.com. So until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count. This is your life. Are you who you want to be? This is your life.